Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 210. It's Monday, May 15th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get to it and start with one that gets at a large social determinant of health. This is from Medical Express. U.S. families experience more chronic food insecurity now than 20 years ago, finds study. More families are chronically food insecure than they were 20 years ago, according to a study led by a University of Michigan researcher. The finding comes at a time when SNAP and similar benefits may decrease because of the expected end of the federal public health emergency for COVID-19. The survey study, published as a research letter in JAMA Pediatrics, compared rates of food insecurity, defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as a lack of consistent access to enough food for every person in a household to live an active, healthy life, 20 years apart, they measured it. Using data that follows the same families over time, lead author and U of M researcher Nuara Insulara found that the rates of families reporting chronic food insecurity between 2015 and 2019 more than doubled compared to families surveyed in 1999 to 2003. There are varying levels of being food insecure. These range from people being anxious about not having enough food to the most severe, such as skipping meals or having their children skip meals, actually going without food. It is not just that there are more instances of having one wave of families saying they didn't have enough to eat, but that it actually persists wave after wave. Previous research has shown that children who face food insecurity, were more likely to have anxiety, depression, poor diet quality, higher rates of diabetes and obesity, and lower academic performance. Conversely, kids who had access to SNAP, which is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and WIC, the Supplemental Program for Women, Infants, and Children, benefits were four times more likely to be food. If they received those benefits, they were four times more likely to be food secure as adults compared to kids who had no access to those benefits. Yes, sirree, folks. If you don't have consistent access to food, that does not bode well for your health. Okay, next up, an interesting story on autoimmune disorders. This from Medical Express. Autoimmune disorders found to affect around 1 in 10 people. A new population-based study of 22 million people shows that autoimmune disorders now affect about 1 in 10 individuals. The work, published in The Lancet, also highlights important socioeconomic, seasonal, and regional differences for several autoimmune disorders and provides new clues on possible causes behind these diseases. Autoimmune diseases occur when the normal role of the immune system in defense against infections is disturbed, resulting in mistakenly attacking normal healthy cells in the body. Examples of such diseases include rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 diabetes, and multiple sclerosis. There are more than 80 types of autoimmune diseases known. Some autoimmune disorders, such as type 1 diabetes, are reported to have increased over the past several decades, raising the question as to whether the overall incidence of autoimmune disorders is on the rise, driven perhaps by common environmental factors or behavioral changes. Exact causes of autoimmune diseases, particularly with respect to relative contributions of genetic predisposition, or environmental factors, also remain largely a mystery and are subject to much research. Because individual autoimmune diseases are rare, and because there are so many different types of autoimmune diseases, it has been very difficult to undertake sufficiently large studies and establish reliable estimates to answer these questions. They found that, taken together, these 19 immune diseases studied affected about 10% of the population, 13% of women, and 7% of men. This is higher than previous estimates, which ranged from 3 to 9%, and often relied on smaller sample sizes and included fewer autoimmune conditions. So it's important to note that women have a much higher prevalence of autoimmune diseases, at 13% for women and 7% for men. This is also very interesting and sort of parallel to so-called rare diseases. There's actually like 10,000 rare diseases. So each individual disease is very, very rare. But when you add them all together, as many as 30 million Americans have a rare disease. So this was a good study here that when you combine the whole host of autoimmune diseases, the prevalence gets up to about 1 in 10 people. If you have an autoimmune disease, you are not alone by any means. Okay, next up, a story on social media and kids' health. This is from NBC News. Teens should be trained in media literacy and limit their screen time, psychologists say in new guidelines. The American Psychological Association released a set of 10 recommendations for adolescents' use of social media, including training them in media literacy and limiting screen time so it does not interfere with sleep or physical activity. The guidelines acknowledge that teenagers are going to use social media no matter what. So the organization said it aims to offer suggestions for adolescents and the parents, teachers, and tech companies involved in their lives. Other recommendations include tailoring social media use to young people's developmental capabilities, screening routinely for problematic social media use, and limiting how much teens use social media to compare people's beauty or appearance. There's a lot of talk about social media these days, including some suggestions that do not fit with the science, said the American Psychological Association Chief Science Officer Mitch Prinstein, a co-chair of the advisory panel that developed the recommendations. We are releasing this report now to offer a science-based and balanced perspective on this issue, so all stakeholders can make decisions based on our expertise regarding benefits and potential risks associated with social media. Experts who made the suggestions hail from various areas of psychology. They analyzed the latest research to determine where science has reached a consensus about teens and social media. While some of the expert recommendations are practical, like providing teens with resources about the positive and negative sides of social media, others are more nebulous, such as minimizing teens' exposure to, quote, cyber hate. Prinstein compared teens' social media use to driving a car, in that keeping adolescents safe should be a team effort that includes policymaking, parental supervision, and changes from the companies that make the products. Social media is here to stay, Prinstein said, so we need to teach kids how to get the best they can from it and avoid the worst. Concern has been rising over what young people consume on social media and how it affects their views of themselves. Politicians and lawmakers have put the companies behind social media apps such as Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat under increased scrutiny amid reports that some users have struggled with body image issues and suicidal ideation, among other mental health effects. Last month, a bipartisan group of senators introduced legislation that would require social media users to be at least 13 years old and mandate parental consent for users aged 13 to 17. Legal cases against some social media companies are also making their way through the judicial system. One class action suit, which consolidates more than 100 similar cases, alleges that social media is harmful to younger users and likens its addictiveness to that of opioids or tobacco. The new recommendations target a variety of stakeholders, parents, educators, tech companies, and adolescents themselves. The hope, Prinstein said, is that the parties collaborate to help young users have positive outcomes when they use social media. Emma Woodward, a clinical psychologist with the nonprofit Child Mind Institute, said the recommendations are most likely to be helpful to people who interact with teens every day, like parents and teachers. She suggested turning the individual guidelines into conversation starters with teens. I certainly think the best way to help kids to be safe online is for it to be a collaboration between parents and their kids or their teens, said Woodward, who was not involved in creating the recommendations. That collaboration is probably going to lead to the most success in terms of helping kids use social media safely. Okay, next up, news on harm reduction. This from the Associated Press. U.S.-backed study of safe injection sites, overdose prevention. For the first time, the U.S. government will pay for a large study measuring whether overdoses can be prevented by so-called safe injection sites, places where people can use heroin and other illegal drugs and be revived if they take too much. The grant provides more than $5 billion over 4 years to New York University and Brown University to study two sites in New York City and one opening next year in Providence, Rhode Island. Researchers hope to enroll 1,000 adult drug users to study the site's effects on overdoses, to estimate their costs, and to gauge potential savings for the healthcare and criminal justice systems. With U.S. drug overdose deaths reaching nearly 107,000 in 2021, supporters contend safe injection sites, also called overdose prevention centers, can save lives and connect people with addiction treatment, mental health services, and medical care. There's a lot of discussion about overdose prevention centers, but ultimately we need data to see if they're working or not, and what impact they may have on the community, said Dr. Nora Volko, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which awarded the grant. Sites operate in 14 countries, including Canada, Australia, and France, according to the Drug Policy Alliance, a group working for decriminalization and safe drug use policies. The grant marks another move by the Biden administration towards what is known as harm reduction, a strategy focused on preventing death and illness in drug users while helping them to get care as opposed to punishment. In December, the National Institute of Health established a harm reduction research network to study programs providing services and supplies such as naloxone, a drug that can reverse overdoses, and materials to test drugs for fentanyl, a powerful opioid driving record numbers of overdoses. The new study will be part of that project. So this grant doesn't support these sites. It's going to study the use of them and see how effective they are and the costs and benefits. Okay, and somewhat related, other drug news. This is from the Washington Post. FDA blocks marketing on 6,500 flavored e-cigarette products. The Food and Drug Administration last Friday blocked 10 companies from marketing or distributing 6,500 flavored e-liquid and e-cigarette products, part of its campaign against tobacco products being marketed to youths. The agency said the product applications covered a variety of flavored e-cigarettes, including some with flavors such as citrus and strawberry cheesecake, as well as cool mint and menthol. The FDA said the companies in question did not provide sufficient evidence that marketing the products would be appropriate for public health. Today's decision to deny approximately 6,500 products was based on the lack of scientific evidence provided in the applications, said Matthew Farrelly, director of the Office of Science within FDA's Center for Tobacco Products. We will continue to ensure all new tobacco products undergo robust scientific pre-market evaluation to determine whether they meet the appropriate public health standard to be legally marketed. The FDA said it received applications for more than 26 million new tobacco products since spring 2020, most for e-cigarette products. The regulator has reviewed and taken action on more than 99% of them, it said. Now, I must admit, I'm a little skeptical as a journalist here. I hope the Washington Post did fact-checking, but 26 million new tobacco products in spring of 2020? I'm not sure for e-cigarette users, there are 26 million users in the United States. So I guess everybody wants to develop their own e-cigarette product. Yeah, so it's obviously a lot, but I'm a little skeptical of the 26 million new products applied for. The FDA move not only blocks the companies from marketing or distributing their merchandise in the U.S., the agency said that retailers who sell them risk an enforcement action. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears a little bit and do a couple stories, one about U.S. support for nuclear power, another one about the costs of air pollution from oil and gas production, not the burning of oil and gas, but just the production of it. And both of these stories in tandem really help get at the fact that if we're going to understand a problem, we have to look at it in its full context. For instance, with nuclear power, you know, it's often said that it's, you know, like zero carbon and this kind of thing, but you've got to mine, you know, uranium. Uranium has its own problems. You have to build and operate nuclear plants, which takes up a lot of water, heats water, has environmental effects, the obvious catastrophic risks that nuclear power brings. That's not something you measure every day and just average out if it happens. And we've had several major meltdowns already, and it's anticipated that we'll have more given the ones that are in operation. And if we increase those, that's obviously going to increase the risk. So let's go. First up from Grist, U.S. support for nuclear power soars to highest level in a decade. A Gallup survey released in late April found that 55% of U.S. adults support the use of nuclear power. That's up 4 percentage points from last year and reflects the highest level of public support for nuclear energy use in electricity since 2012. In a recent report, the Department of Energy found that regardless of how many renewables are deployed, the U.S. will need an additional 200 gigawatts of advanced nuclear power, enough to power about 160 million homes to reach President Biden's goal of hitting net zero emissions by 2050. 160 million homes, that's got to be half the homes in the country. So that's just bizarre thinking that at the center of renewable energy is nuclear power. Yikes. Okay, on with the story. In addition to the Department of Energy's modeling, the International Energy Agency Net Zero by 2050 scenario found that in order to fully decarbonize the global economy, worldwide nuclear power capacity would need to double between 2022 and 2050. In Congress, nuclear power has enjoyed some rare moments of bipartisan support. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle have joined forces to pass a few successful pro-nuclear laws. The 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law injected $6 billion towards maintaining existing nuclear power plants. And while the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act was an entirely Democratic effort, it included a technology-neutral tax credit for low-carbon energy that can be used for nuclear power plants. The climate spending law also allocates millions in investment for advanced nuclear research and demonstration. And of course, in Congress, every nuclear power plant in the U.S. is a congressional district, and those people that have them in their districts tend to support them, such as our Representative Marcy Kaptey has been a big supporter of Davis-Bessie, which has the worst safety record of the nearly 100 nuclear power plants in the United States of America. Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit old because I worked on some anti-nuclear stuff over 40 years ago. So, yes, I am that old. And I hope to live to see a nuclear-free world. Okay, another story to kind of compare and contrast and learn some lessons from. This one from Medical Express. Air pollution from oil and gas production responsible for $77 billion in annual U.S. health damages, study finds. Despite global efforts to transition from fossil fuels to clean energy, oil, and gas production, it's nearing record levels in the United States, posing concern among health experts about what this oil and gas growth means for air quality and human health. These health impacts affected communities in states with high oil and gas production, as well as states with limited or no gas activity, underlining the need for comprehensive regulatory action to protect Americans from the pollutants generated by this sector. While there's extensive research on the climate effects of oil and gas-produced methane, a key contributor to air pollution, few studies have measured the health effect of the air pollution that oil and gas activity generates. Published in the journal Environmental Research Health, a study found that air pollution from the oil and gas sector in the United States has substantial adverse impacts on air quality, human health, and health costs. The findings show that pollutants nitrogen oxide, a fine particulate matter, and ozone from U.S. oil and gas production contributed to 7,500 excess deaths, 410,000 asthma attacks, and 2,200 new cases of childhood asthma across the U.S. in 2016. Factoring in related respiratory and cardiovascular-related hospitalizations, adverse pregnancy outcomes, and other health challenges, oil and gas production are responsible for $77 billion in annual health costs. Comparatively, this total was three times the estimated climate impact costs of methane emissions from oil and gas operations. The study results suggest that oil and gas emissions reduction policies, such as the forthcoming EPA methane regulations, may produce immediate and significant air quality benefits to human health, along with significant climate benefits. The researchers urge policymakers to consider these co-benefits in future emissions reduction strategies. They also stress that strategies that focus on end-of-pipe pollution controls during combustion, such as in power plants, vehicles, buildings, and industry, are only addressing part of the problem. These substantial impacts from oil and gas production show that there are serious consequences across the full life cycle of oil and gas, from well to wheels, well to power plant, and well to furnace, says study corresponding author Jonathan Bonacari, assistant professor of environmental health at Boston University School of Public Health. The health impacts are not just from the combustion of oil and gas. In order for energy, air quality, and decarbonization policies to successfully protect health, they need to incorporate health impacts across the full life cycle. The five states with the highest impact from oil and gas pollution were Texas, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, were those with significant oil and gas activity. However, Illinois and New York, states that produce very little oil and gas, still land in the 6th and 8th spots. And I'll notice Ohio's on that list, and I'll remind you, as I've reported before, that for air quality, Ohio is ranked 50th. So we have a problem. Curbing oil and gas emissions is one of the fastest, most cost-effective ways to reduce methane and other pollutants, air pollutants, which improves air quality, protects public health, and slows climate change, says study co-author Ananya Roy, senior health scientist at Environmental Defense Fund. There's also more work to be done to quantify the health impacts of emissions that the study did not examine, such as benzene and formaldehyde. Exposure to these pollutants, which have been detected near oil and gas wells, can cause cancer and several other adverse health impacts, and quantifying them will demonstrate even higher public health benefits of controlling emissions from this sector. So this is a good article that really does tie the fact that with oil and gas burning, we tend to think of the climate change, and of course climate change has a huge effect on public health. But there are more immediate and direct effects of the pollution just from the production, not even the burning of these fuels. And that's $77 billion a year just for the annual U.S. health damages just from oil and gas production. Yikes. But with oil and gas and nuclear, there are huge industries behind them, and capitalism seems to be doing quite well, regardless of the health of the planet and its inhabitants.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, we have a story on updated breast cancer screening recommendations, which have been a little bit contradictory and have changed in the past, so pay attention. This is from Stat News. Breast cancer screening should begin at 40, not 50, Federal Health Panel recommends. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force last Tuesday created new draft guidelines recommending all women begin screening mammography at age 40, a decade earlier than previous guidelines, and continue screenings every other year until age 74. The change is bound to be controversial, adding fresh fuel to a long-standing debate around when people should begin breast cancer screening, how often they should do it, and if specific groups, such as black women, ought to be screened differently. The task force is widely considered to be the most influential voice in population health recommendations, and some of its recommendations determine what procedures health insurers must cover. But its latest decision has seemed to please few cancer screening researchers, with some saying the new guidelines overstep while others argue they don't go far enough. Independent experts say they are also unsure why the task force chose to update the guidelines now, given that the statistical models that help guide the screenings have not shown dramatically different results since the panel's last mammography guidelines in 2016. I think people are going to be surprised, says Ruth Etzioni, a biostatistician who studies cancer screening at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and who is not a task force member. Change always happens over time, obviously, as the evidence evolves. At the same time, there needs to be a compelling reason, and in the materials here, I don't see a compelling reason yet. She added, when I looked back at the 2016 modeling studies, the harm-benefit analysis was very similar. All cancer screening, including mammography, has the same goal: catch cancers earlier when they're easier to treat and often still curable with procedures like surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. But this also means screening millions of people before they have any sign of disease, which would be an easy policy to espouse if it was entirely harmless. Breast cancer screening can save lives. It has also done so for And it has done so for countless individuals, but it can also lead to false positives, unnecessary biopsies, and, to a lesser degree, diagnosis or treatment of cancers that paradoxically never needed intervention. Organizations that set screening guidelines guidelines, including the Preventive Services Task Force and the American Cancer Society, try to take into account both the benefits of saving lives and the potential harms of unnecessary screening. These organizations use the best available evidence from clinical trials, models, and incidence, morbidity, and mortality data to come up with their recommendations. How they settle on their recommended strategies while looking at the same data is very much a judgment as opposed to a clear scientific answer, Etzioni said. The American College of Radiology, for example, recommends starting breast cancer screening at age 40 and continuing every year. Of course, the radiologists would say that. The task force, on the other hand, had recommended in 2016 that people start screenings at age 50 and go every other year until age 74, with people making individual decisions with their doctors about whether to get screenings in their 40s. The American Cancer Society has a more moderate approach, recommending women start screening every year at age 45 with the option to switch to every other year at age 55. Task Force members say there were three main new pieces of evidence that played a role in creating new guidelines, which are now open to public comment. The first is that recent data from the National Cancer Institute and the Breast Cancer Surveillance Consortium showed that breast cancer incidence among women in their early 40s is steadily ticking up in women by a rate of 2% per year. It's more than we've ever seen before, said John Wong, a task force member and internist at Tufts Medical Center. A second factor was an update in modern breast cancer screening technology, which can offer a slight reduction in false positives and an improvement in cancer detection, as well as updates on new, more advanced breast cancer treatments such as new targeted therapies, immunotherapies, and combination therapies. Finally, Wong said the task force also incorporated a new model that specifically analyzed the harms and benefits of different screening strategies for black women. We know African-American women in general tend to have cancer diagnosed at later stages and subtypes that can be more aggressive. So this recommendation is particularly relevant for black women, said Wanda Nicholson, a task force member and an OB-GYN and epidemiologist at the George Washington University School of Public Health. The task force updated its model with these new data and then compared the harms and benefits of screening every other year from age 50 to 74 to starting screening at 40 or 45 within the same intervals. Overall, the additional harms incurred from moving the starting age at 50 to 40, as measured by unnecessary biopsies and false positives, appear to be slightly less in 2023 compared to what the model showed in 2016. But the task force member said the benefits now appear much greater. With this recommendation, we can see 20% more lives saved. The models also showed that starting screening earlier led to a near doubling in life years gained, according to Task Force Wong, compared to what the 2016 models had shown. Put another way, earlier screenings gave people more benefits for the same amount of harm by moving the age from 50 to 40 in the new models compared to the older ones in 2016. The benefits of earlier screening there were also much greater for specifically black women, the task force said. Thus, the panel felt it was reasonable to recommend people begin screening at age 40. The task force also made a few other statements, noting that there was insufficient evidence to recommend a separate screening guideline for people with dense breasts, which can make it harder to detect lesions on mammograms, or for black people. The guidelines also don't apply to individuals with especially high risk for breast cancer, like those who are BRCA1 or 2 gene carriers. Those notes underscore the need for every person to think carefully about their personal preferences and risk for cancer. The guidelines are just that, recommendations. There's always room for an individual woman to have a conversation with their trusted health provider with regard to mammography. Ultimately, how and when to screen should be an informed but personal decision. So this is a very good overview, and I think that the criticisms that were given in the middle of the article are well addressed by what the task force work was, and just a good example. So I think we're actually, I'm very pleased because this has been something that has been deeply argued, and I tend to not favor the earlier screening, but new research with slightly better treatments, slightly better screening, increasing rates of cancer in those younger age groups, all that put together makes it better with all the pros and cons for those women in their 40s. Okay, well, next up, I have a really interesting story that talks about how well telemedicine does, and this happens to be for cancer care. This from Medical Express. New research finds telemedicine consistently outperforms in-person visits for cancer care when both are available. New research in the May 2023 issue of the Journal of the National Comprehensive Cancer Network finds that telemedicine consistently outperformed in-person visits for both access to care and provider response, according to a long-term study on patient experience. Researchers analyzed survey responses from over 39,000 patients across more than 50,000 visits. Telemedicine experiences were compared to in-person visits during and after the height of the COVID pandemic, starting April 1, 2020 and running through June 30 of 2021. The researchers reviewed Prescanase survey data from over 33,000 patients who had in-person visits and almost 6,000 patients with telemedicine visits. When it came to access to care, 63% of in-person visits were rated as highly satisfying versus 76% for telemedicine. The corresponding rates were 84% for in-person and 91% via telemedicine for high satisfaction with the response and amount of concern with the response and amount of concern demonstrated by their care provider. So to kind of make those numbers make a little bit more sense, basically with telemedicine, you're over one-third more likely. With in-person cancer care, you're over one-third more likely to have a less than a highly satisfying visit than in-person. So telemedicine held up very well in this instance. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, another great story that really illustrates how profiteering often in healthcare often may produce profit, but it doesn't necessarily produce better healthcare and sometimes even worse. This from the New York Times. Corporate giants buy up primary care practices at rapid pace. It's no surprise that the shortage of primary care doctors, who are critically important to the health of Americans, is getting worse. They practice in one of medicine's lowest paid, least glamorous fields. Most are overworked, seeing as many as 30 people a day, figuring out when a sore throat is a strep infection, or managing a patient's chronic diabetes. So why are multi-billion dollar corporations, particularly giant health insurers, gobbling up primary care practices? CVS Health, with its sprawling pharmacy business and ownership of the major insurer Aetna, recently paid roughly $11 billion to buy Oak Street Health, a fast-growing chain of primary care centers that employs doctors in 21 states. And Amazon's bold purchase of One Medical, another large doctors group, for nearly $4 billion is another such move. The appeal is simple. Despite their lowly status, primary care doctors oversee vast numbers of patients who bring business and profits to a hospital system, a health insurer, or a pharmacy outfit eyeing expansion. And there's an added lure. The growing privatization of Medicare, the federal health insurance program for older Americans, means that more than half of its 60 million beneficiaries has signed up for policies with private insurers under the Medicare Advantage program. The federal government is now paying those insurers $400 billion a year. There's a big pot of money everyone is aiming at, said Aaron Fuse Brown, director of the Center for Law, Health, and Society at Georgia State University, and an author of the New England Journal of Medicine article about corporate investment in primary care. It's a one-stop shop for all your healthcare dollars, she said. Many doctors say they're becoming mere employees. We've seen this loss of autonomy, said Dr. Dan Moore, who recently decided to start his own practice in Enrico, Virginia, to have more say in caring for his patients. You don't become a physician to spend an average of 7 minutes with a patient, he said. The absorption of doctor practices is part of a vast, accelerating consolidation of medical care, leaving patients in the hands of a shrinking number of giant companies or hospital groups. Many already were the patient's insurers and controlled the distribution of medicines through ownership of drugstore chains or pharmacy benefit managers. But now, nearly 7 in 10 of all doctors are either employed by a hospital or a corporation, according to a recent analysis from the Physicians Advocacy Institute. The companies say these new arrangements will bring better, more coordinated care for patients, but many experts warn that consolidation will lead to higher prices and systems driven by the quest for profits, not patients' welfare. Experts warn these major acquisitions threaten the personal nature of the doctor-patient relationship, especially if the parent company has the authority to dictate limits on services, from the first office visit to extended hospital stays. Once enrolled, these new customers can be steered toward chains of related businesses, like a CVS drugstore or Amazon's online pharmacy. This consolidation of medical care may also run afoul of state laws that prohibit what is called corporate medicine. Such statutes prevent a company that employs doctors from interfering with patient treatment. An expert warns of the potential harm to patients when corporate management seeks to control costs through a Byzantine system requiring prior authorization to receive care. But other pathways to profit also explain why corporations covet these deals. Unlike the caps on insurers' money-making, where a Medicare Advantage insurer has to spend at least 85 cents of every dollar on patient care, there are no limits on how much profit these doctors' practices and pharmacy chains can make. So I think this is the real gist of it, because particularly as more patients move into Medicare Advantage, which is privatized Medicare, they're limited. They have to spend 85 cents of every dollar on patient care. But when they create these huge consolidations, they can drive a lot of profits from the other sectors that aren't coming out from the insurance of Medicare Advantage by controlling physicians who are controlling much of the healthcare given in this country. Well, as good a sign as any that we need an everyone in and nobody out. Public health, not private wealth. Healthcare for all, please.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up we have an Ohio story. This from the Akron Beacon Journal. 10 Ohio hospitals closed labor and delivery services since June 2022. Access to maternity care continues to decline in the United States and in Ohio, with multiple maternity wards closing in the past year. Since June 2022, the Ohio Hospital Association has counted 10 maternity wards closing across the state, according to spokesman John Palmer. Some merged or moved to a partner hospital. But Palmer said the reasons given for the closure center around workforce issues, operational costs, and a decline in use due to fewer births in Ohio. In Ohio, 13 of the 18 counties have little or no maternity care, and the state had the most women, approximately 97,000, impacted by overall reductions in access to care in the past 2 years, according to the March of Dimes data. Now, of course, Ohio is a large state, but we have the largest cohort of women, almost 100,000, who have been impacted by these reductions in access to care. Probably not the way that Ohio wants to be leading the pack.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal healthcare. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, I'd like to end my regular reporting this episode with a bit of a heads up, specifically for gay and bisexual men. This from the Washington Post. Monkeypox, now known as Mpox, showing signs of return. It's time for gay and bisexual men to pay attention to Mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, again. That's the message from public health authorities and LGBT health providers as cases rise in some countries and small clusters of infections in vaccinated people have been detected in Chicago and France. The World Health Organization on May 11th said Mpox no longer presents a public health emergency of international concern because global cases have declined and countries are better equipped to respond. But that doesn't mean the threat is eliminated. Last year's Mpox outbreak started in the spring, driven in part by festivals, pride events, and other celebrations popular among gay men where attendees are traveling and having sex with new partners. I don't think it's a very high risk right now for people, but it's something they need to be aware of and take action for as they plan for the summer, said Dimitri Daskalakis, a top federal official on the Mpox response. Public health authorities aren't expecting a repeat of last year's explosion of cases, more than 30,000 in the U.S. and 87,000 globally, because of greater awareness and widespread vaccination and protection from earlier infections. But smaller-scale outbreaks are still possible, including in those with some immunity. Officials warned last year that they could not say how long protection against Mpox from the vaccine would last. So party somewhat carefully here, people, as we have festivals and pride events and other celebrations during coming up to Gay Pride Month in June. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular segment of the episode, Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increase enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. Have 17 bonus articles this week. First up, the electrifying everything movement's consumption problem. Electrification offers an opportunity to rethink how we use energy. Will we squander it? So this is really a follow-up what I've covered in the last couple episodes about how we really need to be concerned both from a capitalistic consumer perspective and a climate change perspective that electrifying everything is good. But of course, if we're electrifying it, if electricity is coming from natural gas and other non-renewable sources, it's not really that great. And all the mining costs for lithium for batteries and all kinds of rare metals can be really destructive and actually energy intensive and producing carbon in and of itself in the production. So, very good long read to get more detail on that. Doing a couple Ohio stories up. Number two, Ohio opioid settlement panel's records must be public, top state court says. So, they have hundreds of millions of dollars that they need to distribute from these one lawsuits for people and companies distributing opioids, and they were thinking because they're pseudo-public that they wouldn't have public records laws apply to them. The top state court says no. Yeah, a win for transparency. Thank you, Ohio court. Bonus article three, Ohio Republicans approve August special election that could thwart abortion rights push in state. So this is a really cynical move to spend tens of millions of dollars having a special election just in the hopes of raising the ballot initiative requirement of 50% to get something passed to 60% and changing a bunch of other rules like you have to collect in all 88 counties rather than just 44. They're getting rid of the time period some days after they submit ballot signatures that if they don't have enough, they can collect a few if signatures are deemed bad or not valid or whatever. So it's really anti-democratic. Let's vote that down, Ohio. Bonus article four. Report documents sharp increase in crimes against abortion clinics post-Roe. So this is just another interface. When you're criminalizing healthcare, probably going to cause some, unfortunately, the whole worldview behind that is violence. And we're seeing a sharp increase in crimes against abortion clinics since the fall of Roe. Now, some of us might have hoped that actually these crimes against abortion clinics would have subsided once the anti-abortionists largely won. But no, it doesn't seem like there's any end. If anything, the crazies are getting crazier. Okay, bonus article 5. As more hospitals create police forces, critics warn of pitfalls. So sort of a follow-up article to that. When you're looking at the basic approaches of public health, it's sort of the opposite of law enforcement. It should be non-judgmental and compassionate, whereas police forces often are the least well-suited to deal with either mental health patients or rowdy hospital patients of another variety. So there are plenty of pitfalls there. Bonus article 6, overdose prevention centers are a tough sell in U.S. despite successes. Another example of where the law enforcement approach tends to be a natural default in U.S. culture, even though that the non-judgmental overdose prevention centers have shown a lot of success. There again, another example where public health is swimming a little bit upstream there, but there is progress being made on that. As I reported earlier, the feds are now going to study the effectiveness to try to reinforce how effective and cost-effective these overdose prevention centers are as a harm reduction strategy. And a sort of related story, bonus article 7, the tragedy of the Golden Gate Bridge's $400 million anti-suicide net. So, you know, people throw themselves over the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, dozens of them, every year. But spending $400 million on a suicide net is sort of like the drug war's equivalent of interdiction. You know, it's like the opposite of prevention. You know, rather than trying to prevent the suicidality and the suicidal behavior, it's trying to catch somebody literally in a free fall, you know, seconds before they would be killed. Yeah, a little bit downstream there. Okay. Bonus article 8 is a little bit of a win here. A new blood donation rules allow more gay men to give in the U.S. So this gets rid, it modifies the questions that are asked. It's not biased towards gay men, and it's asking based on risky behavior to all potential donors. And this is both good for donors and for the Red Cross, and it's removes one more area of stigma that gay men have in U.S. culture. Bonus article 9, federal rules don't require period product ingredients on packaging labels. So states are stepping in. I do this one just as an example because often cases, states are what end up leading national efforts. And also, when you're talking about product ingredients on packaging labels, if any states, particularly larger states, start requiring that, a lot of those products that distribute nationwide end up, to meet the requirements of a state or two, end up meeting that requirement for all of their products throughout the whole country. So it's something to keep an eye on, and this one specifically with period products. These ingredients, which people have found PFAS and other, you know, these forever chemicals and stuff, and because period products exposed to mucous membranes, which are more likely to absorb dangerous chemicals, it's all the more important to know exactly what you're getting. Bonus article 10, a plastic sheet with a pouch could be a game changer for maternal mortality. So worldwide, there's a lot of maternal mortality. We're the highest for so-called advanced economies. But a simple plastic sheet with a pouch, basically when you put it under the woman who's delivering, you can, in real time, monitor how much blood they've lost. And knowing that can save lives by this simple monitoring technique for something that just costs a buck or two. Bonus article 11. Cervical cancer screening doubles when underscreened women are mailed at-home testing kits. So this is important for cervical cancer screening, but also it's just a larger lesson and an example. There are hundreds, if not thousands and thousands, of things that we can do that are relatively low resources, but take a little ingenuity and effort. that can reach underscreened women in this case for cancer screening. Doubled. That's a very large increase. Bonus Article 12. Socioeconomic diversity in U.S. medical schools has decreased. So this is part of a larger story I've reported on a lot. And this particular research shows that we're seeing an increase in the wealthiest students, which is basically the same size of the decrease that we've seen in the poorer students. So we're going the wrong direction here. Rather than getting increased diversity, we're getting less diversity socioeconomically. Bonus Article 13. Amid opioid crisis, doctors turn to antidepressants for chronic pain, despite their unproven efficacy. So this is basically highlighting a new research that's showing that antidepressants don't work well for handling chronic pain. And of course, it's a good example of the over-medicalization of chronic pain and healthcare in general in this country. There's a lot of non-pharmaceutical interventions for chronic pain that work much better. Bonus Article 14. Internal pharma documents reveal strategies used to corrupt the medical field. So it's no surprise that big corporations are corrupting to helping professions like the medical field. And this is actually, if you're kind of a geek who's interested in those strategies, this is a very good delineation of all the different ways, in this case, how pharmaceutical companies corrupt the medical field. Bonus Article 15, the medical care that helps no one. An ICU nurse discusses futile care that is confusing and traumatic for family members, demoralizing for doctors and nurses, and dehumanizing for patients. So this is another story in a series of articles that I've reported on end-of-life issues. So often people who have really no hope of even becoming conscious again are given all kinds of so-called care. And this is confusing and traumatic for family members, demoralizing for doctors and nurses, and dehumanizing for the actual patients. And an interesting one here, Bonus Article 16, sex. Sexual intercourse, neither. Teens weigh in on evolving definitions and habits as sexual intercourse prevalence among teens continues to decline. So this decline in prevalence of sexual intercourse among teens has been going on for quite a while. But this article kind of gets at some of the issues with the rapidly changing views and practices about sex and sexuality. Even defining sex and sexual intercourse is getting a little interesting. So, and having worked as an AIDS program director during the entire 90s, dealing a lot with sexual health, it's a very interesting discussion if that's your fancy. And last but not least, Bonus Article 17, going wide, worldwide, polluting cooking methods is a stubborn problem in much of the world. So we kind of take it for granted that we got an electric or gas stove. And while I've reported on the fact that they're trying to phase out gas stoves here in this country because they're more polluting and have health risk compared to electric stoves, it's a whole different world for about a third of the people on the planet do not have completely whatever what would normally consider to be safe cooking methods. That are non-polluting. And actually, in the third world, the contribution of pollution from cooking methods is basically the equivalent of smoking. So in the industrialized countries, smoking is one of the is a much bigger factor with outdoor air pollution as well. But indoor air pollution from cooking methods is a huge problem in the third world. You can view these articles and all of the articles I've reported on this episode and previous articles and listen to all previous episodes if you like by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, The Science of Public Health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-